Welcome to Weekly, a show where we, the writers of Eurogamer, recap the website for you. Remember, supporters of Eurogamer get these episodes every Friday, whereas everyone else listens from Monday. You can find out more about supporting us in the description below or on our lovely website. I'm Bertie, a longtime writer for Eurogamer, part of the furniture, really, and I'm joined today by Editor-in-Chief Martin Robinson. Hi, Chief.
Hello, how's it going?
Good, thank you. And Features Editor Christian Donnan. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Now, I want to begin with something that had Christian and, well, a large part of the world quite excited this week, very excited. And those were the first images from the James Webb Telescope. Now, this isn't some guy called James Webb who's just standing in his back garden somewhere with a NAFOL telescope. This is a full-on proper deal. Christian, on a scale of 1 to 10, how exciting was it?
Oh, like 10. Like 10. It was super exciting. And it was wonderful.
Talk us through it a bit, because you were probably the most excited person on the team. Why is it so exciting? What are we seeing? What's going on?
Well, so I am old, and I remember in 1995, I was still at secondary school when the Hubble Space Telescope started sending, once it was fixed, the Hubble Space Telescope started sending back these extraordinary pictures, including Pillars of Creation, the famous sort of stellar nursery. And at the time, it was the most advanced space telescope. And we were seeing the universe in this completely new way. And the universe was suddenly incredibly dynamic and exciting. And you were seeing, you know, a place where stars were being born out of sort of dust and stuff like that. It was very exciting. And I think James Webb is the next step forward. So it's this huge, relatively speaking, huge telescope that's in the Lagrange point between Earth and the sun. Lagrange point, anyone who's read enough sort of Arthur C. Clarke, he bangs on about the Lagrange point all the time.
Lagrange. It sounds so sophisticated.
It is, yeah.
I mean, ask a dumb question.
Yeah. I won't know the answer.
Who is James Webb?
Pardon me?
Who was James Webb?
Do you know what? I knew the answer once.
Who was James Webb? Sorry.
Who was James Webb? I knew the answer once. no longer. So this is good. James E. Webb, who is the administrator of NASA from 1961 to 1968, in the Mercury and Apollo programs.
He did some good shit.
What's that? Sorry? I'm so sorry. We've got this problem again. I can never hear what you're saying. I can't hear what you're saying. Sorry.
That's all right. Is that...
Okay. Yeah. I'm sure we can edit this out.
Did we want to start again or something? Because is that on my side? Is it not?
No, it's my hearing. My hearing aid's on and everything, but I struggle with noises. I struggle to hear sound.
Okay, don't worry.
Okay, so where were we?
Let's just carry on from here. So you were about to tell us, I think, about maybe the images that were coming from the James Webb telescope.
So I read about James Webb first in a book by Stuart Clarke about the search for Earth's twin. I think it may even be called The Search for Earth's Twin. And it was talking about this telescope that was going to go up, and it would be able to, amongst the many things it would be able to do, was to be able to actually look into the atmospheres of exoplanets, so planets surrounding other suns, and be able to tell us about some of the chemicals and the elements that were in there. And in fact, in the first five pictures from the James Webb telescope, which we saw this week, because it's just gone up and it's just started sending, we've just started seeing the first data from it. One of them, not really a picture, but it was a spectrograph of an exoplanet orbiting a sun, I think about 1,000 light years away. And this planet is a gas giant like Jupiter or Saturn, but unlike Jupiter or Saturn, it's very close to the sun. It's very close to its sun. They're called hot Jupiters, I believe, though I may be absolutely mangling this terminology. And Webb looked into its atmosphere and was able to see water there. Well, it'd be sort of water vapor, sort of haze, but that's just enormous. For the first time, you can look we've gone in my lifetime, gone from being able to spot exoplanets because of the way they move past their suns, to be able to use that same moment where they go in front of their sun to actually look inside and see what's in there. And that's just incredibly exciting. But the other images, can I briefly talk about the other images?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, please. So, yeah.
So the first one they revealed was the deepest image ever taken of the universe. And
these images, do they come? They come back like that. No one's touched these up.
No, or, no. People have completely. So they're infrared. They're all. James Webb is an infrared telescope, and we cannot see infrared light.
Okay.
So these are all sort of false color images. They're all sort of colored by people at NASA to give the different sort of wavelengths something that we can see. But that's my understanding, at least. So the first one was which was the deepest view ever seen of the universe. And it had in the background the red galaxies in the background were formed like 13 billion years ago, and the universe I think is only like
that's 13. Quite a long time.
The universe is only 30, I think it's 13.5 or 13.8 billion years old, and so they were you're looking at really the first galaxies formed, and they were able to see what sort of elements were in there, and they were all really basic elements. You're really going right back to the beginning of things. But also that image was very exciting because it had gravitational lensing. A lot of the stuff in the background was sort of distorted, and it was because the galaxies in the foreground, which were about 3 billion years old, I think. This is all my memory, and my memory is terrible. But the galaxies in the foreground, which were much closer and much more recent, the light was being bent by gravity around them, which Einstein predicted. So it's another example of Einstein being bang on the money. That's a great image. But then, so after that, they did the exoplanet. And then I will wrap this up, I promise. We then saw a dying star.
It's interesting.
We saw a dying star that's sort of venting its gases, which is very exciting. And then you saw five different galaxies. I think three of them were like converging, and they were sort of pulling gases off each other, and the gases were becoming extremely hot and creating new stars. It felt very exciting. It's a beautiful image. That was called the quintet. I can't remember the names of them. You'd think I'd prepare this, given that I'm so excited about it. And then the last image, which was just a brilliant piece of sort of storytelling by NASA, the last image was a huge stellar nursery. And it harkened back. It was actually the same image had been taken. The same nursery had been photographed by Hubble, so they could do a direct comparison. But it was very much a throwback to Pillars of Creation. That sort of wow moment of like, here are stars being born. Look at what this telescope's going to do. And the other thing, just very quickly, the other thing that was very exciting about this was these were all photographs which had been taken in the first like 5 days of James Webb. And they were like, this telescope's really fast at sending back images, and it's really fast at working. And we're just going to get, in the next 20 years, it's going to change science and our view of the universe. It's really exciting.
Which is an interesting point to jump on the back on, because although we're not specifically talking about games at the moment, games, of course, draw on scientific advances like this to plot their sci-fi adventures in the same way as fiction and things. It'll be interesting to see if in years to come how this affects games.
If you look at Hubble had a really Hubble was one of those rare scientific things, like I think you probably have to go back to Voyager for another one. Hubble really had an impact on the public consciousness about space and the way they pictured space. And if you look at the thing I linked to in one of the articles we wrote about this was the opening shot of Contact, the Robert Zemeckis film, which came out, I think, in like 97. I was at university, so like 97, 98. And if you look at that opening shot, it's clearly influenced by Hubble imagery to the extent that the Pillars of Creation are very briefly in it. It's just a sort of shot pulling back from the Earth in through gas clouds and things like that. And I think this is the way that they will. If you look at a Halo skybox or Destiny skybox, yes, they're influenced by like Turner and sort of romantic art like that. But they're also influenced by, you know, Hubble imagery. They have the same extraordinary colours, the same sort of expansiveness, the same drama and sort of romance that Hubble pictures of the universe have. And so I think if you see the way that bleeds through into games, but also into cinema and into just books, into everything, it's going to be the same. Hopefully it's going to be the same thing, but more so. We're going to learn things that are just extraordinary. So yeah, I think you're absolutely
right. It's exciting, isn't it?
Oh God.
Yeah. I wonder if it kicks off a new, a bunch of teams now going into space. Although of course we've got some big games already. We've got, Starfield from Bethesda about to come out at probably exactly the right time.
There was a while back.
Yeah, it's been interesting. Go on.
No, after you, Martin, I've spoken more than enough.
It's fine. I was going to say, it was just one of those beautiful moments where basically especially, again, sorry, this isn't really about games as such, but it's just one of those moments where everything's not so great on the planet right now. It feels pretty awful. I think it's especially with the climate crisis literally staring us in the face of this heat wave right now. And it was just one of those beautiful moments where actually we kind of stopped and looked upwards. And it was a rare moment of optimism, basically, in an otherwise quite pessimistic environment around us right now. So it was a beautiful to have that. And obviously games are fantastic at embracing that. And looking up, as you said, about the kind of the bungee skybox is kind of one of those magical bits of wonder that you get in video games. And so it's be brilliant to see how it kind of impacts that. And I'm sure game developers will jump on it.
That's a lovely point. So moving on, to look at the reviews that are on the site this week. So it's a quiet period of time. The quietness continues. But Christian, you were looking at an interesting game this week called Mothmen 1966. And this is kind of a trip back in time, as I understood it from reading the review. Can you tell us a bit about the game?
Yeah, so God, I'm going to be talking a lot today. I'm so sorry, everyone.
like, you're really good at it, it's fine.
When it's radio telescopes and Mothman week, there's really, like, that's the day. That's the week,
like, there's only one guy to call on, yeah.
So the Mothman is this brilliant cryptid who sort of belongs alongside... you know, the Mongolian death worm and the Yeti and the, you know, Bigfoot, this sort of mysterious creature, which is sometimes glimpsed. And I think the main sightings were in 1966 in this place called Point Pleasant in West Virginia. And they occurred just before a bridge fell down and killed like 30 odd people, which is awful. It's since been made clear that the bridge fell down for completely understandable reasons, but sort of the whole sort of Mothman turning up and then something terrible happens was sort of encapsulated in this wonderful book by John Keel, sort of a paranormal investigator who's not afraid to sort of destroy fact in order to tell an entertaining story. And I've always loved the Mothman prophecies because he's sort of a postmodernist, so it's all you're right, you're almost reading this wonderful little bit of fiction that sort of ties in with fact in very vague, unconvincing ways. It was made into a brilliant movie, like a surprisingly brilliant movie, starring Richard Gere, which I urge you to track down. And for years I've had sort of Mothman as this sort of beloved crap cryptid, sort of craptid, if you will, sort of in my memory is this thing that I've sort of loved to think about on winter evenings, sort of staring out into the garden, as you do. And now it's been made into this really fascinating game, Mothman 1966, by a team called LCB Games, who I think are a very small studio, and I believe they're Argentinian, though I may be incorrect, so apologies about that. And it is a throwback to sort of 1966 and West Virginia, but it's also a throwback to the era of really early graphical PC games, sort of CGA games. I don't know what CGA stands for. Please don't tell me what you discovered it stands for. But
yeah, there are various interpretations of means of it, but there's the one I remember is the obviously it was the low tier graphics mode on PC games, yeah, in the mid 90s. Basically,
there was a time when loads of games like North and South, they had like your kind of VGA graphics, which was all color, and then you had CGA, which was in like four different colors, but the colors were kind of amazing. They were like sort of these lurid cyans and like turquoise and greens. And Mothman 1966 takes this kind of green, turquoise, white color scheme, and it delivers a game that really feels like it could have been made in like 1988 or something. It's a visual novel with a little bit of loose sort of choice in there, and also some slightly shonky interactive bits, which I think in my review I was a bit too hard on, actually. I've been thinking about it.
I've
been thinking about it since then. Actually, they were almost, you're almost sort of encapsulating, it felt like they were encapsulating the awkwardness of this era of game on purpose. And everything goes through the same control method, you know, like, so it's like, what if you had an action sequence which you interact with through a text interface, through like deciding, sort of selecting sentences. I think I was a bit hard on it in the review, but it didn't get in the way of the fact that I absolutely adore this game, because it's just pure atmosphere. And it's two atmospheres overlaid, that sort of superpositioning of like Mothman, which I love, but then sort of the early days of PCs, which I love. it reminds me of when I was at primary school, secondary school in the first years, making sort of new friends, and we used to go around each other's house and play on their PCs and like the weird sort of shareware that they that passed around at school. It feels like that. It reminds me, Ollie Welsh, former Eurogamer editor in chief, Ollie Welsh and I, always one of the subjects which we're fascinated by is where PCs used to be in the house and where, oddly, actually where telephones used to be in the house. Like there was this really sort of uncertainty as to where you put your telephone, which is why there's a whole class of, I can't believe I'm talking about this, sorry. There's a whole class of there's a whole class of furniture called like telephone chairs. We've got one in the other room because I'm obsessed with them. But you used to have like a little bit of furniture because you put your telephone in your hallway. PCs were the same. So my friend Gareth, I used to play Monkey Island, and his PC was right by his front door. You'd go into the house, there'd be the front door, you'd come in, and then there was a flight of steps upstairs. And the PC was at the bottom of the steps. So if you fell downstairs, you would die by colliding with the PC. But I love that sort of this technology was going through this stage where just no one knew where to put it. And that's sort of all twisted up in my love of these sort of games. It's a wonderful game and it's on pretty much everything, I gather. Please do check it out. That's what I'd say.
Awesome. Thank you. So we also this week, and this is not strictly... It's fine. We also this week, and this is not strictly a review, but a state of the game piece, this new series we launched where we're looking at games later in their lifetime to see how they are now. We also took a look at what GTA Online is like 9 years after it came out. That's a long time. This is a great piece by Jake Green. He at times loves GTA Online, at times he hates it, and his hate seems to come from everything costing a lot of money to do in the game and everyone else who plays there already having tons of money, so they don't care about, say, killing you and blowing you up and taking the monetary hit that kind of comes with it. But the bits he loves are all these kind of multi-stage heists and DLC-based content that's been added to the game in those 9 years. They even had Dr. Dre come and do like a special partnership, which is so GTA, it hurts. So in his mind, it's a game that's kind of at odds with itself and rooted in this 2013 kind of era. And actually, it's going to be fascinating to see what Rockstar takes from that and what it leaves behind when we get to the next iteration of GTA Online with GTA 6, which is...
It's like, you're right, it's going to be really fascinating because obviously, I think... No, I was going to say the success of GTA Online has been problematic for Rockstar. It hasn't at all. They've made absolutely crap loads of money out of it. But I think it kind of changed the way they made games, and I think it's obviously responsible for the long wait for GTA 6. And it's crazy as well that GTA Online has outlived Red Dead Online, which I think I saw over the weekend. That was basically been effectively killed off. They've stopped working on it now. I think that was on over the weekend, that was confirmed. And it's amazing to see that kind of, whatever magic they bottled this time with GTA Online, they weren't able to do it with Red Dead. And so it's going to be interesting to see where they take it for 6, basically. It's also kind of one of those weird blind spots. It's a blind spot for me anyway, because of I never really got into it. So I've tried to get into it about 3 or 4 times, and then after about 6 hours of just being repeatedly gunned down by randoms, it's like, I'm just going to go back and just play it single player and just mitch around LA. But obviously, it's been hugely successful, and there's even story content in there, because I think a lot of people were hoping for GTA 5 story DLC, which never happened. It just kind of found its way into the online aspect. And there's so much there. So it's like, well, I think that's the joy of the state of the game piece. It's really nice to have someone who actually knows their stuff distill it into something quite digestible for someone like me, who's basically quite ignorant about it. It's really nice to have that kind of little catch up on what's going on in this absolutely huge, colossal
game. He says as part of the piece, there is a new onboarding kind of new player experience in the game. If you do fancy it, you've never played it. But yeah, there still is a quite unfriendly community at times. They're ready to kill you because I think they're just bored.
Isn't that kind of what
they're
you want?
They're flying around and they just...
Isn't that kind of what you want from
GTA?
Yeah,
like,
you don't
thing.
Want to,
like it,
if you went in and everyone's like, oh, hi, so nice to see you kind of thing, you'd be like, this isn't really GTA.
Where am I? Is this Second Life? Also in features, those were the kind of reviews things this week, but in features then, Chris Tapsell had a chat with Relic after previewing the upcoming Company of Heroes 3. I think we can hear Martin's doorbell in the background there.
I was just desperately trying to mute it. It's my doorbell, which is basically, for some reason, I didn't choose this by myself. It's a remote thing. It's behind a bookshelf. And it's when I installed it, I accidentally pressed a button, which made it do this weird sea shanty, and I cannot ever change it. And it's infuriating. So apologies for that. But there you go. There's the backstory of my doorbell.
I think that's brilliant. So Chris Tapsell, Relic, Company of Heroes 3. This one's set in the North African and Mediterranean theatres of war during World War II. And like other games in the series, it kind of aims to zoom right into the kind of individual experience of the wars and what it was like for the people in them. And as you know, like the series has great credentials and everything you could probably want from a new Company of Heroes games looks like it's being ticked off here. But I guess the issue is, do you want a war game at the moment? It's tricky, isn't it? Because they have been working on it and it's nothing to do with them. But I guess we'll see how it fares come November time.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I like Utopia's kind of far removed enough, but it is the appetite for this kind of thing. I'm not sure how much is there. Obviously, we're going to be having the same kind of questions when Modern Warfare 2 comes out at the end of the year, which is going to be the biggest game of the year. And I don't know how much people want to engage in that kind of thing right now. And obviously, it's impacted a lot of games. Advance Wars got delayed. I think the word is it's going to come out later this year. But obviously, it hasn't halted Company of Heroes progress, although it does sound good. Great box as well, apparently, in Company of Heroes 3.
So. In a way, I think Company of Heroes sorry Bertie. Okay, I was gonna say, in a way, Company of Heroes 3, it strikes me that it's better placed for the current moment than something like Advance Wars, which is like war is fun and toy like whereas Company of Heroes has always been rooted in sort of the historical narrative. And I think there are two things that are specifically interesting, delicate about this game. One of them is obviously negotiating the fact that there is currently a war in Europe, which is killing civilians and destroying cities. And the other thing is that it goes back to Rommel, who is a very interesting figure in that for a long time he was seen as being sort of the sort of decent person on the German side, which is much more complex than it actually, the truth is much more complex. But he was sort of, I think he was poisoned, he was killed by Hitler because of plotting to overthrow him and things like this. There were lots of sort of he's had sort of a bit of a complex reputation, which I think this game is trying to unpick. And the reputation not only of him but also of the war that he fought, there was a sort of tidying up of that reputation of the war in North Africa, which sort of ignored some of the atrocities and things like that happened. So I think this game I'm fascinated to see that. My grandfather was captured by Rommel, not personally, but his unit was captured by Rommel at the beginning of the war.
Wow.
It's St. Valery, 1941. And Rommel was famous for taking care of his POWs particularly well. But there's a lot more to the man. And I think it's great that a game is exploring this in hopefully with all of his nuances intact. I should say my grandfather never met him.
Well, I sort of had hope that if...
they were like hanging out.
I still do the rounds and
yeah,
shake
he,
hands.
He captured like thousands of people at once, and my grandfather was one of them.
I hope that if a developer can land this, maybe it's Relic that can manage. But we'll see. Let's see come November. Also in Features Land this week, Ed Nightingale talked to the makers of an imminent Xbox interactive movie game called As Dusk Falls. This is out next week, 19th of July. It's on Game Pass and PC, so Game Pass Day 1, Xbox as well. I'm actually reviewing it at the moment, though I'm under embargo, so I can't talk about it properly until early next week. However, I will sneakily say that it's good. So Ed talked to Caroline Marshall, who set up the new studio behind the game called Interior/Night. She used to work at Quantic Dream, so she brings a lot of experience from kind of cinematic interactive movie games from there. But she also brings lots of experience about what she wants from a company and probably more importantly, what she doesn't want. And inclusivity is a large part of this that she's talking to Ed about. She's also talking about not making game development or game projects marathons, which to me suggests she wants projects to be more manageable and more finishable. And I can really feel this in the game while playing it. And to me, that's really exciting because it means, I hope, that people aren't going to break themselves making games like this. They're a lot more manageable. And this is good for everyone. It's for, good for their creativity, for their improvement, for their prolonged stay in the games development industry, and ultimately for our entertainment. So yes, I find this all very exciting for a number of reasons, and keep an eye on this game, basically.
Yeah, it's one of those genres kind of unchecked potential, and it was obviously hugely exciting around the time of kind of Heavy Rain, and it was because it was kind of kind of more broadly applicable drama, which I was going to say veered away from kind of more typical video game excesses, that made it seem like a more mainstream thing, and actually like this is the kind of thing that actually could make video games more palatable to like an older, broader audience. And I think some studios came to try and do a similar thing. There was Andy Serkis' studio that did the Planet of the Apes game that was promising big things, didn't quite pull it off. Supermassive do a kind of similar but brilliant job with it with their unbelievable amount of video games. That studio's output's crazy. But I guess it does show that these kind of things can be, I guess, turned around in a slightly quicker process, quicker way than the typical AAA cycle. But this looks super fascinating in that kind of way, and it's nice to see it because obviously I think the appetite kind of things was might have been sullied a little bit by Quantic Dream and their kind of various things around that studio, so it's nice to see it kind of restored, and something which is I can be get genuinely excited about. I'm really looking forward to it. It looks amazing. It's got that kind of rotoscoping look, which to me, because I'm old and of a certain ilk, it reminds me of the rotoscoping films of Richard Linklater with The Waking Life and then Scanner Darkly, which is an amazing PK Dick adaptation if you haven't seen it. It's got that similar kind of look to it. And I've not played it myself. I'm not sure how effective it is. I'm not sure. You're probably under embargo. You can't say too much. You could talk about what's out there in the trailer.
The difficulty is that I can't say so. It is very effective. And Ed's interview, I was reading about how they did it because I wasn't sure, because they managed to capture expressions really well, probably breaking embargoes. Now, they managed to capture expressions really well in the game, and it looks like they've almost, you know, taken a reference photograph of it. And in the interview, they say that they actually videoed or they filmed the actors doing it by green screen. So they are actually capturing actors' performances. I think they're just not, you know, lip syncing it up or showing all of the frames they capture. They're just pulling on the ones they need in order to convey the important parts of that scene, which works surprisingly well and comes with some other benefits as well. It's a bit odd to begin with, and I struggled with the art style for some reason. I found it a bit off-putting, but I think once you warm up to it, it's quite exciting. There's a lot of things that bode well for it, but I better not say too more for fear of getting in trouble.
So no, I'm looking forward to it, and it's next week that's out, isn't it?
So the 19th, so that's Tuesday it comes.
We've got two actual video games coming out next week. That's exciting. We've got that and Stray,
the
cat wandering game, which looks fantastic.
That does look good. Until recently there was a cat sleeping on the floor just here, but she's gone outside. Over in Video Land this week, Ian and Zoe played Skyrim together in Skyrim Together. This is the new PC co-op mod that people have been waiting for a long time to play. I really want to play this. And Skyrim with someone else, I don't know what more you have to say. It's that slapstick, knockabout fun. Whereas on your own, you would see what trouble you can get up to with someone else. Like, to me, that just makes so much sense. Of course, Bethesda is in no way involved in making this, so it probably breaks in various ways, although I don't know if them being involved would change that.
No, it probably might break in less ways, who knows.
The team also aired their Quarry playthrough finale. This is by Supermassive, the people who do the dark pictures, and very much interactive movie. But will they get through it with everyone alive? I hope not, because I didn't. And then that would mean they're better than me. Zoe also began a playthrough of a psychological horror game called Madison, which I was watching her play a bit of, and it looks freaky as hell. Proper, you're in a sewer, no lights, you're taking, the only light is like an intermittent flash from your camera, and spooky stuff. And Ian was also thinking out loud about which moments in the Resi 4 remake would be awesome in VR, because all Ian thinks about is VR, apparently. Over in Digital Foundry Land, there's more quarry action, as Tom Morgan took a look at how the game performs on, in general, but on PS5 and Xbox Series X, and was really impressed, calling it a motion capture showcase. I actually watched Tom Morgan play a lot of this because he sits behind me in the office, so I often spin around to basically distract him from what he's doing. And I know how positive he was about the game. But it does it does look great. There's some, the skin is great in the game. It's such a weird thing to say, but they have quite a lot of close-ups of the characters, particularly in the pause menus. You kind of move their heads around. Looks a bit freaky, but it's got some weird mouths. The motion capture of the mouths is weird on some characters. It looks really like they've stuffed someone else's mouth that's too big for their face into their mouth. And it's quite jarring.
They've got such a good formula going as well. I think, sorry to get ahead of ourselves, but their next game's got Jesse Buckley in, isn't it? Which is just strikes me as just like an incredible get, like one of the most exciting talents in Hollywood right now. And she's in starring in the next Dark.
It does, and it's coming out this autumn. Well, it's expected to come out this autumn. And they have one of the news items I'll come to in a bit, is they've just been acquired, Supermassive, by a Danish company called Nordisk Games, who also owns Just Cause developer Avalanche and Metroid Dread developer Mercury Steam, which suggests they're about to get, they've got some money come pouring in. I don't know if they were lacking it before, but I don't know how they managed to do all these projects at once. They're like 300 people. So this is a big, it's a kind of subgenre, but it's obviously going well for them. And personally, I will play, I think, any new game that they put out in this genre. It's just fun to play with other people in the house. It's not too taxing. It's just quite fun to watch and kind of mess around with. I like
it. Yeah, it's a brilliant formula. And like, the Quarry's, I should know this, the Quarry's like more of a full-length game, isn't it? Whereas obviously the Dark Pictures are a bit more bite-sized.
Yeah, this is about 8 hours. So two chunky sittings if you're going to do it with friends. Don't expect to do it all in one night if you've got that. It's kind of like, it's a spiritual successor to Until Dawn. So it's... Yeah, it goes back to that.
Because Until Dawn was obviously kind of the first one, and it looked appalling at first. It started as a VR game, wasn't it? I think it started off as a PlayStation VR game, and I don't think it looked that amazing. Then got, I could be wrong. This is off the top of my head, and my internal Wikipedia is not the most reliable. I think it was a PSVR game, and it looked a bit shaky. Then it kind of got retooled. To amazing effect to become this, to serve the foundation to the ongoing success of the studio. They're doing brilliantly.
Yeah, those games all look great. Also in DF land this week, and I love this, Alex Battaglia installed Windows 98, as you do, on an Xbox Series X, and played a load of old PC games like Quake and Half-Life and Turok and Commander and Conquer. Like, I guess only someone from Digital Foundry wakes up and goes, I know what I'll do today. I'm going to install Windows 98. The upshot was that it doesn't work perfectly because a lot of it's emulated and the GPU is not really being used. And so there's loads of room for improvement, but he's still quite enthusiastic about it. And he walks you, there's a video where he walks you through what he did to get it working, just in case, I don't know, for whatever reason you want to do it.
Can your Xbox Series X do VGA or Super VGA, or does it just do CGA?
I don't know.
We'll find out. Yeah, see what it's capable of. I know. I don't even know if it's even applicable.
Tune in next week to Digital Foundry to find out. So in Newsland this week, Immortality, the new game by Her Story and Telling Lies creator Sam Barlow, has been delayed from this month to the end of August for a bit more polish. This is the Hollywood-inspired investigative horror game that follows the career of a fictional actress. And once again, you have to sort of dig through video clips in order to get closer to the truth, basically. I'm quite excited about this. I've played his other two games. I liked Her Story. I was a bit lukewarm on Telling Lies for whatever reason, but I'm excited to play this.
Yeah, Sam Barlow's fantastic. He's lucky enough to interview him a couple of times, and he's just an absolutely fascinating person to talk to. And obviously, a hell of a track record. I think I'm the same with you as well. Loved Her Story, Telling Lies. Wasn't so sold on. So I'm interested to see the kind of third crack at it.
Yeah,
kind of what his style.
The new look PlayStation Plus appears to be off to a promising start. Its first kind of batch of monthly games was announced. This is the July bunch. And among them, and we mentioned it earlier, is the cyberpunk cat game Stray, and this is like when it comes out, it's going to be on PlayStation Plus as well, which is exciting because it's not something PlayStation Plus, the new PlayStation Plus, is always going to do. And also the enhanced edition of the Final Fantasy VII remake, which again was like a PlayStation console exclusive. That's going to be there. That and Marvel Avengers and some other like older Assassin's Creed games. But that's quite a good start. I think that's quite promising for subscribers.
Yeah, it's really good to see Stray on there because I think like a lot of people, we weren't expecting kind of day and date. I say big releases, like Stray is obviously not a big AAA game, but it feels like the biggest game
definitely
of the month, basically, yeah. because there's not much else out. But also it looks absolutely brilliant. So it's really cool to get that on the service, like free day and date. I mean, it makes it a lot easier for me to play it. So, yeah, that's awesome.
Absolutely. Bayonetta 3 has a release date. That's 28th of October. This is the Switch exclusive Bayonetta, so don't go looking for it on other platforms. That's quite exciting.
It's got a non-sexy mode as well, which I think is the best thing about it.
That's it.
Where basically, yeah, it covers up. So there's a mode you can put on it where it covers because of I love Bayonetta to bits. I would never play it in polite company for various reasons. And I know, yeah, I know it's not, the series is about empowerment and not so much titillation, but still it doesn't stop it being slightly embarrassing when it's basically all her clothes come off and her hair turns into a tax and she's nude underneath it all. And there's a native angel mode in it, which covers up all the skin basically. And so it makes it a bit more appealing to play with a bigger audience. So it's not so, yeah, which I think it's awesome. Not that I'm a prude. I am a prude. I'm going to be switched on straight away because I'm going to find it much more enjoyable to play that way.
Awesome. I didn't know that. That sounds like a great feature and something so Bayonetta. It was brilliant. There's a leaked Skate reboot doing the rounds online, which maybe you've seen, maybe you haven't, but the Skate developer came out this week and was like, that gameplay build is like a year old and it was never intended for external use. I wonder if they're just saying this anyway. And they're pleading people not to download it and play it. This game doesn't have any release date yet and slowly inviting more people to sort of play testing. So yeah, you've been told, I suppose. Bandai Namco, publisher of Dark Souls, Elden Ring and The Witcher 3 a while ago now, confirmed it was hacked. And is investigating a potential customer information leak. There's a, quote, possibility, quote, some customer information was accessed. So fingers crossed that wasn't the case. But check if you're a Bandai Namco customer and you've got stuff related to them, might be worth checking that out. Moving on. Spotify has bought Hurdle, the Guess the Intro music game that was until now powered by SoundCloud. So expect it to move homes soon, I guess. Have either of you ever played Hurdle?
I've not, and I've also just cancelled my Spotify subscription as of like a week ago because of like a lot of people. I think I'm reconsidering all my subscriptions and there's been the great coal in the face of a cost of living crisis and everything. But I've not played Hurdle. I've heard good things, lol.
Which other subscriptions got the axe? Which other ones did you chop out?
Netflix has gone. Amazon Prime has gone. Brutal. I feel ashamed for having Amazon Prime for so long. It's weird, actually. I've the only ones I've kept is really Apple stuff because of Apple Music. I just like Apple Music. It works a bit better for me. And it means I got Apple Arcade as well. I got Apple Arcade back basically recently to play the Yu Suzuki game Air Blaster and then realized it's awesome and then kind of just went all in on it. But yeah.
Nice. Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance 2, the old game this is being re-released for PC, Switch, PlayStation and Xbox next week. That's on Wednesday, 20th of July. And yes, it's got local co-op, unlike the new Baldur's Gate game, which was a bit ropey and didn't have local co-op for some ridiculous reason. A fan has remade the intro to Arcane. That's the Netflix show about League of Legends, which I really liked. But with the characters from Mass Effect, I urge everyone to go and watch this. It's really cool. Sort of Liara's face and Thane and Garrus as you're in place of the other ones. Very good. Also,
Isn't Mass Effect due like TV treatment at some point, or is that happening? I'm not plugged into Bioware stuff. That makes so much sense.
I have no idea, but I don't. Would it be any good? I don't know. I'm not sure about that. Also, in slightly silly news this week, an Elden Ring player has finished the game on a piano. I don't even know what to say. I wonder if it sounded nice.
I doubt it, but I'd actually like to just to see it completely. Yeah, not even see the gameplay at all. Just hear the atonal chaos of someone trying to play through Elden Ring on a piano, so you can identify the key moments, like certain boss fights. There'll be like the heavy yammering.
Yeah, and more importantly, and on a serious note to finish this on, you can now dress as Sonic in a new range of loungewear on sale from the Sega shop. Christian Donlan, will you be buying any of this?
No. I bought
if you do, I'll dress up as Tails. Case, yeah, if you get the Sonic stuff, I'll get the Tails.
I bought Sonic Mania the other day and it's great.
Thank you.
That's my Sonic fact. It's not a fact, it's just a bit of
time for some Sonic pajamas to go with it.
I don't
actually know if Sonic pajamas are part of this range.
I've actually got Sonic the Hedgehog pajamas. I'm not even joking. I shouldn't really admit that.
Well, I don't know why you're not wearing them, to be honest.
Yeah, sorry. Apologies. Next time out, I'll bust them out for you.
We'll hold you to it. Thank you very much, Christian Donlan and Martin Robinson, for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
So much.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Bertie. That was Weekly, and I'll see you all next week. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.